You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
I cover all things food, from cooking to gardening to fabulous ingredients to junk food, health, sustainability, even policy. You might say I'm obsessed with everything about food. Food is the one substance that connects everything to everything else, and it connects us all. Not only can we not live without it, not only does it determine much of what goes on in the world, but we love it. Hi, and welcome to Food with Mark Bittman. Today, we're going to have a conversation with Eric Repair. I first met Eric probably 30 years ago. He was a skinny, up-and-coming kid, incredibly handsome, which he remains. Wonderful chef, great personality, widely loved, but brought a kind of simplicity to New York's fine dining scene that really had not been seen before, like stripped down minimalist food of the highest order and then served in this uber elegant, sometimes frankly overwhelming setting, but always like the cleanest, most beautiful food. And most of it fish, of course, because Le Bernardin was a fish restaurant, is a fish restaurant, but increasingly Eric has moved toward vegetables, and we'll talk about that. It's an interesting conversation. He's a lovely, articulate, terrific man. That's coming up, as well as questions and answers with Carrie and Kate and Daniel and even me, and some recipes, which I think you'll enjoy too, and more coming up on Food with Mark Bittman. Eric's new book, Vegetables Simple, is such a treat that I'm really excited to offer you a couple of abbreviated recipes from it. You can find the full recipes on markbittman.com. They are, like, almost without exception, among the simplest recipes you'll ever find. All vegetables, for example, shaved fennel Parmesan salad. You trim and shave a thin slice or mandolin, a bulb of fennel. You save the fronds. And you toss that with salt and white pepper. And then you add a tablespoon of good extra virgin olive oil and 1.5 teaspoons of lemon juice. And you toss that and then shave about 2 ounces of Parmesan on it. That's it. And I've had that. It is amazing. Similarly, you can take 2 big carrots. This is a recipe a few pages earlier in the book. You take 2 big carrots, you peel and grate them on the big holes of a box grater or in a food processor, if you like. Toss that with salt and pepper, and then dress that with the juice of a lemon and 3 tablespoons of olive oil. So similar but different. Both of these are awesome. If post-COVID you're among the people who are fantasizing about glorious travel, you might want to join me on next April's Mediterranean cruise with Regent Seven Seas Cruises. This is going to be a 10-night sailing from Lisbon to Barcelona. It's an all-inclusive luxury cruise stopping at Cardiff, Funchal, Casablanca, and several other exciting ports. Shore excursions are included, and I'll be leading some of them, as well as doing onboard cooking classes, talks, gatherings, and so on. There's a 2-category upgrade for people who book before June 30th, and Liz Nixon, who is the queen of cruises, is offering exclusive discounts to my followers just for another few days. So if this is your thing, now is the time to do it. We have been posting recipes and other links every Tuesday on markbittman.com, and you'll find this link and this blurb up there as well, markbittman.com. Thanks. My guest today is Eric Repair. Eric was born in the town of Antibes on the Mediterranean coast of France and soon moved to Andorra, which is in the Pyrenees. He began cooking at 15, yes. He moved to Paris at 17. And then he began doing a bunch of things that by necessity include the word legendary. He began cooking at the legendary La Tour d'Argent And then he moved to the legendary Jamin, where he eventually worked directly under the legendary Joe Robuchon as the head fish chef or poissonnier. In 1989, Eric moved to the States and began working for the legendary Jean-Louis Paladin as Jean-Louis at the Watergate, an incredible place, I have to say. We may have met there, although I don't remember it. He then became the sous chef for the legendary David Boulay in New York before he took over for another of my early chef influences, Eberhard Mueller at Le Bernardin. I want to talk about that. Repair has since firmly established himself as one of New York's and the world's great chefs. He got 4 stars at Le Bernardin in 1995 before he was 30 from the Times, 4 stars, and subsequently got 4 stars 5 consecutive times. Le Bernardin is the only restaurant to maintain this status for this length of time without ever dropping a star. Eric is vice chairman of the board of City Harvest, which works to bring together New York's top chefs and restaurateurs to raise funds and increase the quality and quantity of food donations to New York's neediest. He's an old friend, a quiet, well-accomplished man, still young, still vibrant, still fun, as you'll see. And we'll talk a little bit about his career, how our paths have crossed, what he's up to, and his latest book, which is called Vegetable Simple. Eric, welcome.
Thank you so much. And I'm very happy to be with the legendary Mark Bittman.
Well, thank you for saying that. I have to say, I mean, this is going to sound terrible. Well, we can edit it out, but I was called legendary by someone last week and I practically fell over. But anyway, I guess we're getting to the age where no one knows what to call us. So legendary is, I mean, they could say old white guy, I suppose. So.
No, you are a legend. You are a legend with everything you have accomplished in your career. And,
well.
We all know that in our world, the food world. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. We can stop the log rolling, as we say. Let's talk a minute about the difference between working directly for Jean-Louis Paladin, who was, you know, as we both know, 10 times better than I do, but as we both know, a lovely man, but also a holy terror. And then running your own restaurant, running it by yourself. What was that like for a young man?
Well, first of all, when I came to the U.S. and I worked for Jean-Louis, I was coming from the kitchen of Joël Robuchon. They were two different universes.
I can imagine.
And if I can make an analogy, it's like coming out of Catholic school and going straight to Woodstock. You know, like, so obviously Jean-Louis was Woodstock. And It was definitely a culture shock for me, but I learned a lot from Jean-Louis because he was so creative and so generous and very interested by what we have in this country, which is beautiful, beautiful products, from produce to fruits and animals and so on. So I learned a lot from him, but we were working in that very tiny kitchen, and I'm sure you have been in that tiny kitchen many times.
Yeah.
And he was doing miracles every day with the team because he was coming back from visiting a farmer or someone who was harvesting softshell crabs, and he would come at 5 p.m. And he would write the menu for the same night, and whatever you thought would be on the menu wasn't, and you had to redo completely everything, and it was complete chaos, and he loved it, and we actually were having fun with that kind of chaos in his kitchen. Then when I came to New York, it was different, of course. And then when I came to Le Bernardin, Le Bernardin was a very structured and very well oiled machine, and very disciplined in the kitchen as well. So I was departing from the freedom that and the fun that was in Jean-Louis kitchen to something that was fun in a different way, if I may.
Le Bernardin had more of a fixed menu. You knew what was going to happen every day. It was pretty regimented and so on. Do you know,
yes,
the first time I heard a story like the story you just told about Jean-Louis, I think actually Jean-Georges Van Richten told me this story about some place he worked when he was young where the chef would come in and say, no prep, do not do prep. I will tell you the menu an hour before we are due for service, and then you will know what to prep. And to me, that sounds very difficult for the chefs, of course. But as a diner, that sounds like the most exciting thing imaginable.
It can be fantastic, but you take a risk.
Right.
Because it's almost like a guinea pig, because what are the chances that even a genius chef is going to have an amazing idea for every dish, every day, with different ingredients that he finds at the last minute on the markets and so on? It's very unlikely. So with Jean-Louis, actually, I learned how to accept failure sometimes.
Interesting.
Because some of the dishes were not, they were too new. We didn't have time to really train or know if it was working or not. And sometimes when he was eating the right note, it was the best meal of your life, the best dish ever. But sometimes we were like a bit of inconsistent. And for me, it was interesting. It was an interesting experience, because at Robuchon, we were terrified by failure. It was not something that was accepted in that culture. So Jean-Louis really reconciled a lot of things for me by having that kind of I call it crazy, but crazy lifestyle and crazy ideas of bringing ton of ingredients, putting them on the kitchen table and saying, guys, I think we're going to do this and we're going to do that and let's do it. And you were like, oh my God, I have half hour to really do that. And so anyway, it was interesting.
Terrifying, yes. I mean, as someone who on a very minor level is constantly making stuff up and never knowing what dinner is going to look like until it's really cooked. I love that, but I also understand the terror of doing that professionally, to then go out and say, this is going to cost you, I mean, in those days, $20 or whatever it was. But I wonder if you remember any particular dishes that turned out really, really well or really, really badly from the Jean-Louis days. Anything you loved?
Yes. Well, I love 99% of what he was creating. But I remember one day he decided to do something with figs, and he wanted to do kind of a dessert with figs. And he didn't really explain. I don't think he really knew himself how to do what he was asking us to create. And we didn't remove the skin of the figs. And that became so bitter. And the texture was so chewy and so disgusting. And we were like, we cannot really serve that. And we did serve it, actually. One great dish is one day he brought back some live lampreys. So those are kind of like
monsters.
Gigantic. I mean, it's part of the it's fish family, but it looks like a snake, and they suck your blood. They were live.
They are monsters.
They were live. And I was like, he's crazy. We're not going to cook that today. So we killed them and so on just before the service. And he did an amazing, amazing lamprey a la bordelaise with red wine sauce. And he was improvising with whatever we had, and we added to the dish. So yes, some bad experiences that became funny and interesting, like the fig dessert, and then the lamprey, which is the opposite, was like just genius.
I mean, I wonder if there are people with the kind of freewheeling attitude that he had who are willing to do that kind of thing. Now, anyway, Le Bernardin was based on Le Bernardin in Paris. Both are fish restaurants, known for being fish restaurants. There were, of course, fish restaurants in New York and elsewhere before that, but not four-star fish restaurants, not this kind of glorious thing. I mean, I remember it was wonderful when you got there. It has continued, as we said in the intro, to be wonderful. You've brought it along. You have consistently made things fresher, simpler, lighter, and so on. But I wonder how you see things having changed in the last 25, 30 years.
Well, when I started at Le Bernardin, I was very influenced by my background, my childhood. So I grew up in the south of France and in the north of Spain. So all the flavors that I like and ingredients that I like were very Mediterranean-like. And also I was very influenced, of course, by my mentors, which is Joël Robuchon and Jean-Louis Paladin and so on. So the food that I was creating at that time was a polite compromise in between the vision of Gilbert Lecoz, who was the chef and owner of Le Bernardin, and ideas that I had. And Gilbert was from Brittany and I was from the South. So we were meeting in the middle and I was very respectful of him and very admirative of what he had done with Le Bernardin. Unfortunately, he passed away in 1994. It's when I had really the complete freedom to do whatever I wanted. And again, we started to see a lot of influence coming from my childhood and from influences from my mentors. And I started to find my own voice by basically being in the kitchen every day and creating dishes and so on and saying, well, I like this style, or I don't like that style. Actually, I should direct myself to a certain simplicity that I really, really like and remove ingredients from the plates. And actually, I don't really care about presentation. Obviously, it's very important. And at the end, I will make sure that the dish looks good. But my main concern is to elevate the fish to the next level. And everything that's going to go in that plate will have this purpose. So I created the mantra for Le Bernardin that says the fish is the star of the plate, which means we don't cook with fish, we cook for the fish. And whatever is in that plate has a purpose, has a reason to be. And then we have evolved because I live in New York. I'm a New Yorker 30 years later, obviously. And as you know, it's the capital of the world, and we interact with different cultures, and we see different techniques and the ingredients from other chefs. We are in New York. I mean, a lot of chefs in New York are very lucky because they can travel also. So we can go in Asia, we can go in South America, go back to Europe and so on, or visit the US and discover again a lot of great food that comes back and in some ways digested it and comes again in with some influences in the dishes that make Le Bernardin food today. So I would say it's kind of like a natural fusion of cultures that are inspired by my own personal experience. And then again, keeping the mantra, fish is the star of the plate, let's keep it simple, and let's gather the best ingredients possible. And therefore, this is what I think the evolution has been in the kitchen. And Le Bernardin has evolved at the same time in the dining room with the service. That was very formal, became much more interactive and relaxed. And also the decor in the dining room that was very French 1990s, yeah. 1980s. Yeah. And today it's much more contemporary with very conducive to high energy and so on.
I wonder how the fish itself has changed. We were both around in the 80s and early 90s when suddenly you could get fish from anywhere in the world via FedEx anytime you wanted. And I remember going into restaurants and them bragging about, oh, we got this from Honolulu, or we got this from Japan, or we got this from Spain. And then we went through a period where, no, that was not what you wanted. You wanted to say, we got this from Maine, and we got this from Cape Cod, and we got this from Long Island, and we got this from off the shore of New Jersey, off the coast of New Jersey. In other words, the fish is local, and really, you know, this is what our area represents. I know you've been through all of that. How has that evolved, and where are things around fish at now?
Well, first of all, we do not serve farm-raised fish. It's all wild ever. And all sustainable ever.
Wow.
Except for the salmon from the Faroe Islands. And they are probably the best farm in the world by far. But they have fjords and they close the fjords and very few animals that eat the natural food that is on those fjords. And then they have a way of making them grow and be happy and so on. So that it's almost like eating wild salmon, but it's not. But except for that item, everything is wild at Le Bernardin. Everything is sustainable. We don't want to serve endangered species. And then I would say 90% of the fish comes from the East Coast, in between North Carolina and Maine. And that's where we find most of our species. And the benefit of that is, first of all, we support the local fishermen in our region. So it's helping the economy, obviously. And then we have fish that is super fresh. I mean, I called Portland, where they have an auction house for the fish, at before 6 o'clock at night, and I will get the fish in rigor mortis tomorrow morning before 7 o'clock. You cannot beat that.
No, you can't. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And are you limited much by, if you're saying you're not serving, you're only serving sustainable fish, are you limited much by that? Are you getting a variety that...
As you know, we have those lists, right, that are telling you. So you have in the red few species, and then the yellow few species, and the green is whatever is sustainable. And those lists are very subjective, in my opinion, because a caught fish that is caught by a tiny fisherman with one line is not the same code that is caught by a factory boat or something like that. And yeah. So therefore, sustainability is very subjective. You have to use your common sense. You have to use those informations that come from organizations like NOAA, which is a governmental organization. And then you find your way, and you know what is sustainable or not. Now, I have to say, in the US, I'm very impressed by the efforts of the government to create sustainability. They have a very strict rules, and the fishermen follow those rules very carefully, because they will lose the license and their boat if they cheat. So they have quotas of fishing. They have areas where they can go and fish. They have seasons where they can catch the fish or not. When the fish is reproducing, they cannot go, and so on. So we are in the US pretty well off with making sure that we do not deplete the population of the fish. One of the great success stories is the striped bass. And I'm sure you remember at one point striped bass was on the verge of disappearance, and the stock was collapsing and so on. And the government stepped in, and with the fishermen worked together. And today, striped bass is plentiful. And for many, many years, we are enjoying that fish that is local and from the East Coast.
We're going to take a quick break now, and we'll be back with more in just a minute. I'd like to segue to vegetables and talk about how that's changed at the restaurant and maybe a little bit in your life, and then we'll talk about the book. But some in my mind, and maybe in yours too, fish and vegetables are similar. They go together. They are anti-meat in a way, not anti, but apart from meat, and very varied and zillions of types and so on. So maybe you feel the same way. I don't know.
Well, first of all, I love vegetables. So when I was a kid, I had a grandmother that was Italian, another one who was from Provence. My mother loved fine dining. However, we were not eating meat and fish every day. In Europe, we were eating fish on Friday because it was a tradition. And then very often on Sunday, you had a roasted chicken or a leg of lamb. And then during the week, very little meat or fish. Again, a lot of different preparations with vegetables. And again, I was lucky to be in the south of France where we had the best vegetables.
And the best.
The taste and the fruits too are amazing. So I love all my life, I love eat vegetables and cook vegetables. And what I realized a few years ago is that, yes, at Le Bernardin, I enjoy tremendously creating with seafood and I eat fish every day. But on the weekend, when I entertain, especially in the spring, in the summer and beginning of the fall, I go to the farmer markets. I go to the farm stands if I am in the countryside. And I have tremendous joy in shopping and seeing the new string beans and the fava beans and the peas and the asparagus right now, or during the summer, the tomatoes. And then I bring all that back home and I do a little bit like what Jean-Louis Paladin taught me. I put it on the table and then I improvise. And I cook all those vegetables very often separately with different techniques and spices and so on. And I have 8, 9, 10 different preparations. And then I put them in the middle of the table. We invite, I mean, with COVID, it was a challenge, but we usually invite 10, 12 people along the table. And it's very convivial and we share and everybody takes a bit of anything they want. And we pay homage to each vegetable. They have their own personality. I call that personality, their own qualities and so on. And because of that lifestyle, I said, you know what? I should do a book about vegetables. Why not? And that's why I created Vegetable Simple.
When you were young, it sounds like you were eating, and maybe we can talk a little about specifics. It sounds like you were eating Italian, Southern French, Mediterranean. Vegetable Simple is the simplest collection of vegetable recipes I have ever seen. The title is perfect. When I think of Le Bernardin away, when I think of you, this is what I think of, the simplest treatment of something that is legitimately called cooking in a way. It's very much like your fish. Can you talk about that, but also a little bit how different that is from what vegetables were like when you were growing up?
So vegetables, when I was growing up, were coming from... I was going with grandmas to the market, or my grandfather had a little garden in the back of the house, and I was eating those vegetables. And they were not necessarily beautiful, and they had little stains and so on, but they were really, really flavorful. And then when I live in Paris, when I was going to the markets, the vegetables were beautiful too, and delicious as well. But when I was going to supermarkets, they were just beautiful. And in America, when I came to the US, I was shocked by how beautiful the vegetables and produce were. But I was also very disappointed by the flavor. To me, it was such a huge difference in between the European products that I knew and the American products. And it's because they cultivate it in a different way to have more yield and so on. And they harvest when the vegetables and fruits are not ripe, and therefore they can keep them for a long time. But vegetables that are not ripe and that become ripe in a supermarket don't have flavor. So that was for me a big challenge. Now, we are very lucky in New York. As you know, we have Union Square Market on the Upper West Side. We have a huge market on Sunday that is next to the Museum of Natural History. We're starting to see a lot of organic products that are ending in stores and so on, that are coming from small farmers. And it's a big movement in the US to support the local farmers. And that has made a huge difference for the quality of the produce that we are using.
And the difference in complexity of dishes that you grew up with, vegetable dishes, and the kinds of dishes that you have in this book, which are cook this simply, put the tiniest amount of sauce on it, here you go.
Actually, one recipe in a book has two ingredients. I mean, we don't call the salt and the pepper, but you take the tomato and you put olive oil on it, rock salt and cracked pepper. It's called tomate croquelle in French. It's an appetizer. So if you have a tomato that doesn't taste like anything, that is full of water, and you cut that tomato, and you put olive oil, salt, and pepper, well, it's no pleasure. It's no flavor. It's nothing. It's just like red. But if it is the end of August, beginning of September, and you have some beautiful tomatoes coming from a farm stand, from a little guy, and you choose the right one, and you cut it, and you put olive oil, and again, rock salt and cracked pepper, you are in heaven. It's an experience. You're like, my God, this is the best thing in the world. If you have something that is amazing, it doesn't need much to elevate the qualities of it.
Well, I think you really show that well in here. It's an unusual book in its simplicity and beautiful. So congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
It's impossible not to talk about COVID. People are very curious about what happens in every restaurant in the last 16 months or whatever it's been, and the famous restaurants especially. So can you walk us through a little bit about what the Bernardin experience was like since last February, March?
Sure. I think it was on March 10. I was watching the news constantly at Le Bernardin. We had a TV screen in our office, and I was like, this is going to be really bad. And the virus was in America, and New York seems to be a target. And I said, we cannot take the risk anymore to be open. We cannot take the risk for our employees, for the purveyors, and obviously the clients. We have to close. So I closed on Friday the 13th, a week before it became mandatory. Mm-hmm. And I was, of course, devastated, but at the same time, very relieved that nobody got sick. None of our, we had 180 employees at the time. None of them got sick. And then we were closed, I thought, for 2 weeks, and I will see them again, or 3 weeks maybe. And as you know, we were closed from March until October. So that was extremely, extremely difficult financially, as you can imagine, for a business to stop like that and have no income at all and have a lot of expenses is extremely, extremely challenging. However, we were able to survive the crisis because we were very conservative with the way we managed the restaurant and so on. We did a GoFundMe for our employees and raised $200,000+. We did another fundraising for our employees a bit later, and we raised $250,000. So we were helping them in that way. We were trying to find jobs for them as private chefs or in other states where it was not as bad. And the employees were kind of fine. We reopened in October at 25% capacity with a very strict protocol. And we even installed some machineries in our ceiling that killed the virus and so on. And we operated like that for 2.5 months. Then the governor shut us down again. And again, nobody got sick. And I was very happy about that. And then we finally reopened mid-March this year. And since then, I mean, now we are at 75% capacity, but we were until last week at 50% capacity. And since then, it's much better. However, Le Bernardin is in Midtown. The buildings are empty. People are working from their house. So we're not open for lunch. And then Broadway is closed. So we don't have people that are going to the shows, but we do about 110, 120 covers a night. We don't have any private events. So all of those things are challenging, but we are able to operate normally and to compensate our employees properly as well with good salaries and so on. And now we are waiting for, again, New York to be at 100%, Broadway to reopen, people to come back to work, and then we will be fine. But I see the light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm very happy that nobody got sick. All our employees are vaccinated, and that's also a relief for us.
Has the food changed in the last year? Were you able to work on new dishes? Did you think about things differently?
We have been working on new dishes, of course, since we closed, and our menu has changed quite a bit with, again, new dishes. It is challenging to find good products in general because a lot of little, especially when you deal with little companies or little farmers or fishermen, right? they have been so challenged by the crisis. A lot of them, unfortunately, went bankruptcy, and a lot of them closed. And you do not find the products easily because it doesn't exist any longer. I take an example. It was a family in Maine that was picking crab meat. And that family had the best crab meat in the Northeast. And they couldn't sustain because their clientele were high-end restaurants all over the country and some luxurious hotels, mostly. And then when we closed, they couldn't sustain it. So they're doing something else.
Right.
And therefore, it's difficult. We have to find another source. We have to teach people to do the right thing. And it will take a bit of time, but it will come back.
I mean, I know there was little about COVID that was pleasant for anybody, but I wonder if you found solace or joy or whatever in cooking for yourself for a change.
Well, yeah, you're right. Overnight, I became the private chef of the family. And I was in charge of breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And when we were actually in lockdown, I posted on Instagram all the food that I was doing for the family with limited supplies, whatever we were finding at the stores. And so nothing esoterical, nothing expensive. Very simple recipes that do not require 12 pots and pans, because then I had to clean the pots and pans. Right. I didn't have 12 burners. I didn't have help and so on. So I documented those recipes to help people that were in lockdown. And then in May, with World Central Kitchen, which is the organization of José Andrés, and City Harvest, that is the biggest food rescue organization in New York and in the world, we worked together. And Le Bernardin was doing 400 meals a day that were going to doctors and nurses that were staying in our neighborhood in hotels. They were here from out of state to support the New York doctors that were either way too tired or sick by the virus. And then at one point, all those doctors and nurses left, went back to their states, and we cooked for shelters. So we were cooking 5 days a week, 400 meals for shelters until December, from May to December.
Were you doing those 400 meals at the restaurant or some other kitchen?
No, in our kitchen, in private events. And we were doing that. And we were doing really, I was very happy. And I actually took a lot of pictures for my social media to inspire people to show what we were doing, because the purveyors were very nice to us. They were giving us the food at cost, or sometimes even like they were really gifting us the food. And we were able to give food that was restaurant quality to people in shelters. Like when we were giving salmon steaks, was like an 8-ounce steak of fresh salmon with beautiful vegetables that we had at the time, and also something, a starch to be nutritional, right? And a sauce. We were making a sauce every day, a different sauce. And actually, to make sure it was good and at the same time it was practical for us, we were eating that for our own lunch.
And why not?
If it was good for us, it was good for everybody else.
One more question, and then I'll let you go. What have you been cooking for yourself recently? Let's get specific. What are you eating?
Last Sunday, I made a chicken stew. Almost like a Navarin of lamb, you know, like which is a stew with spring vegetables and paprika and so on. But I did it with chicken. And as an appetizer, I think I find some beautiful asparagus, and I made an herb vinaigrette with the herbs that we found. And the desserts, usually I don't take care of that because I'm really lousy. And the family refused to eat my desserts. So no desserts.
That sounds appropriate. Well, soon you can give them strawberries, I think. So
yes, they're coming.
But this was really fun. It was great to catch up. Thank you. I appreciate it.
It was my great pleasure and honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Another recipe from Eric Ripert's new book, Vegetable Simple. This is Warm Golden Beach with aged balsamic. So you take 8 medium-sized golden or yellow beets, trim off the greens. You don't have to peel them, and you boil them in water to which you've added a cup of red wine vinegar and a big pinch of salt. So you cook that until the beets are tender, which is an hour or so. If you have to add more water, do. And a thin-bladed knife that you poke into it will pierce the flesh easily when they're done. While that's happening, you take half a cup of aged balsamic vinegar and reduce it by half, which takes about 10 minutes, 8 to 12 minutes, Eric says. Cool that while the beets are cooking. And when the beets are done, turn off the heat, let them cool in the cooking liquid. When you can handle them, the peels will slip right off. If you've never done that, it's really quite amazing. Slice the beets in half, season with salt and pepper, and drizzle with that reduced balsamic. A lovely recipe.
Okay, now's when we're going to answer a few questions from listeners.
Hey, Mark. My name is Julia Shulman. I use your book all the time, by the way. I have a pet peeve. Why, when you're in a restaurant, before you even taste the food, the waiter comes around with this huge pepper mill and asks, pepper? And shouldn't the food be seasoned properly before it leaves the kitchen? I never ask for more pepper unless I taste it first. But many people will just say, okay, pepper. Why?
Freshly ground black pepper? Well, it started in the 70s, which is a long time ago, but it's just become this thing that shows that you're a good restaurant, that you offer freshly ground black pepper. So I have two interesting stories about this. One is that my father, who, as you know, was a maniac, once went insane in a restaurant because they didn't offer him freshly ground pepper. Like, what kind of restaurant is this? No one comes over and offers freshly ground pepper. That's one. And the other is probably the reason they started bringing pepper mills out from the kitchen or wherever, from the back of the restaurant to the table, is that people used to steal pepper mills. And I was once at a restaurant, again, with my parents and my friend Bruce, and I think his parents, and we brought our friend, who I refer to by his initials, which are JB, and JB stole the pepper mill, and they came running out after him and embarrassed us all in the parking lot. So, but it is sort of, yes, of course the food should be perfectly seasoned, but you might want to put your own salt and pepper on it. I mean, my big pet peeve surrounding this is that they've taken, and this is pre-COVID, they've taken the salt off the table. So now you have to ask for salt if you want salt. So yeah, it's a minor annoyance, but hopefully my story's made up for it.
We're going to address one of your questions now with Kate and Daniel.
Hello, this is Helen Conroy. Is there some step for cooking prep, or baking for that matter, that one always sees in recipes, but that you routinely ignore?
I have one that I can think of off the top of my head, and that would be peeling ginger. I don't do it. I just take the ginger out, and I don't chop it either. I just grate it with a microplane, and it seriously has saved me so much time every time. It's an awesome trick, and I'm super proud of it. Daniel?
That's a good one. Now that you mentioned, it's funny, I was racking my brain when Mark asked the question, but now that you mentioned that, I feel like there's a million prep things that I never do. I don't peel carrots. I don't think I've ever peeled a tomato in my life. Not that all recipes call for that, but some do, and I don't think I've ever bothered. I never cut the little stem tip off of garlic. People can eat that, not a problem. I don't devein shrimp, which a lot of people don't like, but I just don't do it. I've never had a problem. People only complain when I tell them that I don't do it. They don't complain when they're eating the shrimp. So that's in the prep category. Cooking, I feel like there's probably a lot more. I don't soak beans that much because I don't typically know that I want to eat beans tomorrow. I usually just know that I want to eat beans today. So I just throw them in. That seems to be fine. I often don't wait for the oven to preheat, especially when roasting vegetables or something. It's hot and it's getting hotter every second. So just put them in there and watch. When they're crispy and they seem tender, you can eat them. Baking, I don't know. I mess with less and I bake less generally, but I don't think I've ever sifted anything before flour and baking powder and baking soda all together. I think that's out. I'll measure in baking. I won't really measure that much in cooking, but we all seem to survive.
I'm with you. I went through a period of not even peeling garlic because my copy editor at the Times, Pat Garowski, used to say, well, the peel's going to come off somewhere along the line, but then you have to fish it out. So tomato peeling, absolutely. The shrimp deveining thing I once did a story about, and there were people who said shrimp tastes better if you don't devein it. So that was it for that. That just confirmed that that was the way to go.
Right now, we're going to pause, and Carrie is going to take one of your questions.
Hi, this is Sarah Bills from Portland, Oregon. My question is, my family loves crackers, but I find the amount of packaging that comes along with store-bought crackers to be just too much. Do you have a great go-to cracker recipe so that we can make them at home? And bonus points for a grain-free cracker for when my celiac friend visits.
Hiya, Sarah. Carrie here, and I'm going to help you with a rather breathless version of Mark's crackers. The full recipe appears on the Bittman Project with a lot more detail, but I think we can do it. 400-degree oven, preheat with a pizza stone or a metal baking sheet to get hot while you make the dough. Then you're going to cut 2 tablespoons butter or good quality vegetable oil or olive oil and 1/2 teaspoon salt with 1 cup flour. I'm going to take the gluten-free challenge and say you can either use a 1-to-1 baking mix. People like Bob's Red Mill, though I haven't tried it for this recipe. But I'm going to go for 1/2 cup each chickpea flour and brown rice flour for a whole grain version. Doesn't that sound good? Let's try it. It either works or it doesn't. Okay, onward with the dough that does work. We've got this coarse meal now. We're going to add 1/4 cup of water. It should come together in a ball. If it doesn't quite yet, add water 1 tablespoon at a time till it does. Knead a couple times, then cut the dough in half. We're going to work in batches. Put a piece of parchment paper down and sprinkle it lightly with flour, and then roll the dough to 1/8 inch thick. I know it's thin, but the dough is forgiving, and so are we. So you have to patch it, whatever it takes to get there. Then score it into the triangle, squares, or rectangle shape you and your family like. And then the most important thing is poke it all over with a fork. This is called docking to help it bake evenly, you know, like saltines. It'll look a little bit like saltines. And then you take that whole piece of paper and pop it on the hot surface and let it bake for 10 minutes before you peek underneath and see if it's brown. If you've got some goldenness going and the dough is firm to the touch and starting to get colored on top, then take it out. Otherwise, let it go another 3 to 5 minutes. Put it on a wire rack and let it cool while you work with the other half of the dough. Resist the urge to eat all the crackers right away. Let them cool, break them into pieces, and then store them in an airtight container, and they'll keep for a couple days.
That's it for this week's listener questions. If you have a question about food, cooking, or whatever, call our listener question line at 833-FOOD-POD, or to put it another way, 833-66-3763. I want to remind you, I want to just say before leaving, keep cooking. But remember, too, that the fight for better food for all is really a fight that involves justice, social, legal, racial, environmental justice, and more. Better food for all means better agriculture, more democracy, less inequality. Again, more than that, too. But in short, a better world is possible. Let's try to make it that way. I want to thank Eric again for joining me today on the podcast. I thought it was a really awesome interview, or at least I had fun. I hope you enjoyed it. You can order his new book, Vegetable Simple, or buy it wherever you buy your books. And you can follow Eric. The spelling of his name is E-R-I-C-R-I-P-E-R-T at Eric Repair on Twitter and Instagram. And he is Chef Eric Repair on Facebook. Folks, if you liked today's episode, and if you're still listening, I can assume that you did, then please subscribe to Food with Mark Bittman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you like to listen. It would be real helpful if you left us a 5-star review on Apple, and detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. You can find the recipe from today's show in the episode show notes or at bittmanproject.com or at markbittman.com. They all kind of go to the same place. Finally, Food with Mark Bittman is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Check out Airwave's other shows at airwavemedia.com or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Mark Bittman, and thanks again for listening to Food. See you next week.